For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Welcome to another episode of No Script, No Problem here on Believe, the number one podcast network for professionals. Do you believe? I'm your host, Steve Berkowitz. If you enjoy No Script, No Problem, please subscribe and rate the show. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, and TuneIn. You can also find it on Believe.com and at Believe Podcast. Follow me on social media. You can get me on Threads, Blue Sky, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Mastodon, and Facebook. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Believe at Believe.com. All right, let's get started. Coming up on the show, I'll be chatting with Rachel Dyer and Scott Ruderman. They are the filmmakers behind the powerful Paramount Plus documentary film Pay or Die, which highlights the devastating financial costs of insulin and the physical and emotional toll this takes on people suffering from diabetes, as well as their families. But before we get to that, it's time for your reality check. First up, Netflix added 9.3 million subscribers in the first quarter of 2024, up from the 4.9 million that Wall Street had projected. That gives them a whopping 269.6 million subscribers as of March 31st, 2024. That is huge. The company also beat analyst forecasts with $9.37 billion in revenue. After a slowdown, yes, we all remember this, in 2021 and 2022 that caused a domino effect across the entertainment industry, the streaming giant is on track for almost, get this, $10 billion in earnings this year before interest, taxes, and non-cash costs. However, here we go, the streamer said it planned to stop reporting subscriber totals beginning with its first quarter results in 2025. Now, that is a big deal. Subscriber numbers have been the most important metric at the company for most of its existence. This decision by Netflix did spook investors as their stock did dip. Netflix has been killing it for the past 6 months with new subscribers because they eliminated password sharing, but that growth is going to end soon. So come 2025, they're thinking, why do we have to show you these numbers that aren't going to be as spectacular as we'd like them to be? So let's just show you the good stuff, which is their profits. They show you what they want to show you. If they want to show you great engagement numbers like they did towards the end of last year, that's what they're going to do. And speaking of good stuff, for Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO, good news is $49.8 million is what he got in 2023 as his total pay package. Meanwhile, his heavily vested friend David Zaslav, the Warner Brothers Discovery CEO, received a total compensation package of $49.7 million in 2023. Now, while WBD is certainly not doing as well as Netflix, that is up 26.5% from the previous year. And how is WBD doing? You're wondering to yourself. Well, Warner Brothers Discovery, the Disco Bros, their stock is down almost 50% since the companies merged in 2022. The base salary for Zaslav was $3 million, and stock awards, that's valued at $23.1 million, and his cash bonus was $22 million. He also got over $700,000 for personal security, and he got to use the company's private jet. I look forward to seeing some new vests out of Mr. Zaslav. Now, while both Ted and Zaz are fattening their bank accounts, neither of them seem to be buying as many shows as folks like myself would like. All around town, folks are having trouble selling shows, selling movies. Production is down in Los Angeles, especially for television projects. On-location filming, according to Film LA, has declined by 8.7% in the first quarter, recording only 6,823 shoot days from January through March of 2024. TV production was down 16.2% year over year in Q1. And even, this is specific to myself and my colleagues. Reality TV production dropped 18.6% in the first quarter to 1,317 shoot days, while location-heavy TV drama production dropped 5.5%, and less location-heavy TV comedy production plunged 51.5%. Need more evidence of the trouble the entertainment industry is in? I don't need any more evidence, but here's some. Anyway, independent studio Participant Media. Now, if you're not familiar with Participant, this is the company behind Spotlight, which won an Academy Award, the Green Book Academy Award, Inconvenient Truth, RBG, Murderball, and Roma. That company, Participant Media, is shutting down after 20 years. This was the top social impact-based studio in the industry. They backed these movies that maybe, you know, weren't going to make a ton of money, but they had great messages. That company, gone. Great article that kind of hits a lot of these issues that we're facing. It's called Life and Death of Hollywood. You can read it in Harper's. It's by Daniel Bessner. Definitely an important read. Bessner opines that the film and television industry is facing an existential crisis with writers and other workers. And he doesn't include reality TV producers, but I will. He says the writers are losing out while top talent and executives make more money than ever before. I will throw in there that celebrities now have more production companies that dip into unscripted projects and eat up much of the EP fees. Bessner continues, writing that the rise of Netflix and the streamers which followed initially provided many job opportunities, but the oversaturation of content via the proliferation of the streamers and prestige TV, along with the shift towards IP-driven projects and a focus on profitability instead of subscriber growth, has led to increased precarity, fewer series, smaller season orders, and less steady work. Most certainly. I co-sign on that. Bessner states that the future of the industry is uncertain, with continued contraction, layoffs, and a shift towards safer four-quadrant content. This means more spinoffs, prequels, sequels, and reboots, and less big swing risks on original concepts. And then lastly, before I get to the interview, Accenture, the consulting firm, and I'm not the biggest fan of consulting firms, but they did a really deep dive into what's going on with the entertainment industry as part of a big report called Reinvent for Growth. And just really quickly, a couple of the results from this big study from Accenture. The media industry is facing significant challenges, including dwindling financial returns, competition from tech giants, and a fragmented digital market. Big tech companies are expected to grow more than 2 times faster in operating cash flow than legacy media from 2023 to 2025. Traditional media companies and producers need to embrace radical reinvention to ensure survival and success. That is much easier said than done, Accenture. I can attest to that as a quote-unquote traditional media producer. So radical reinvention sounds amazing. It is not that easy. The report continues. Examples of radical strategic moves for traditional media companies include shifting to new roles in the entertainment value chain, tapping into new sources of revenue, rethinking customer segments, and exploring new growth areas. Some of the findings from the study, which included 6,000 global consumers, 55.9% of those surveyed expressed frustration at having to pay for multiple platforms to access their desired content. Oh, these are the same people who didn't want cable. Okay. 65.5% found it inconvenient to repeatedly enter personal information to access new services. Yeah, I'm surprised it's not 100%. 36.2% said they struggled to find something entertaining. And making that worse, 52.2% said recommended content did not match their interests, exacerbating the problem. Yeah, I'm going to agree with that, because so many times, whatever Netflix or any of the streamers recommend to me, I am so not interested in it. We see a 26% plummet in linear TV viewership since last year, contrasting with the 57% increase in subscription video on demand, 52% social video increase, and video games increasing 50%, spaces where legacy media companies have little to no footprint. And most importantly, highlighting a seismic shift in entertainment preferences. 59% of consumers regard user-generated content, like what you see on YouTube or TikTok, as equally entertaining as traditional media, signaling a competitive upheaval in the quest for audience attention. And 58% place as much trust in the voices of independent content creators as they do in established news outlets. That is terrifying as the election approaches. Gen Z does not care about broadcast and linear television. They are way more interested in YouTube and TikTok. And if we don't adapt to that, we're screwed. Okay, enough of that. Let's get to my interview with Scott Ruderman and Rachel Dyer. They are the directors of Pay or Die, which you can stream now on Paramount Plus. Pay or Die exposes the desperation, survival, and heartbreaking reality faced by diabetics who are grappling with their chronic illness and the high cost of insulin. While the recent Inflation Reduction Act has capped insulin costs at $35 per month for Medicare enrollees, providing some relief for many who rely on this life-saving medication, the insulin crisis still exists. And that is what Scott and Rachel are focused on in Pay or Die. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. It is critical information. Take a listen. Rachel Dyer, Scott Ruderman, thank you for joining No Script, No Problem.
Thank you so much for having us, Stephen.
Thanks, Stephen.
All right, the film Pay or Die, about the skyrocketing prices of insulin. It's a crisis here. And Scott, you have a very personal connection to this story. Why don't you both of you take your turns here? Talk to me a little bit about the genesis of the project. Always a good way to start.
Absolutely. So Stephen, I live with type 1 diabetes, you know, and being a freelancer in the film industry, you know, kind of always caught my eye that this is quite expensive, even with insurance. How are people doing this? But it really wasn't until Rachel and I crossed paths and we found ourselves in Canada together, and Rachel encouraged me to go into a Canadian pharmacy to see if I could actually purchase insulin at a lower cost. And it was true. The pharmacist came out and offered me all the different vials at a price that was, $19 Canadian at the time. And, you know, insulin in the US out of pocket, a few hundred dollars. It was quite shocking. And it was an interesting feeling of, you know, joy and frustration. And that was a hard moment for us. So when we came back to the United States, we started doing the research because we knew we had a film to make. Healthcare in America is completely unjust, and we want to do something about it. And the best we can is through a film. And once we started doing the research, we were quite shocked of the amount of people that were struggling to afford insulin, let alone life-saving medications.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, as you can hear, I'm Australian and also half Canadian, so I didn't grow up in the medical system that we have in the US, but I have been here for 10 years now. So when I first moved here, I was a journalist primarily and was doing a lot of medical refugee stories where there are Americans crossing the borders to go to Mexico, to go to Canada, to go and source their life-saving medication. So I knew from covering those stories that, it was just a really shocking situation to even have a term like medical refugees for Americans leaving the country. And I just knew that I wanted to do something about it. And it wasn't until I met Scott and learned more about insulin and specifically type 1 diabetics and how it is life or death within, you know, such a short time period and the injustices that so many Americans were facing. So yeah, that was kind of the catalyst from my perspective to really want to open up not only people from outside of America to kind of look in and say, how could this be happening in a first world country like America, but also to educate, I think, a lot of Americans that don't know any other systems to understand it doesn't need to be this way. And it isn't this way in a lot of other countries.
And the film follows essentially three families who are dealing with this crisis in different ways. How did you go about finding these three families and deciding, okay, this is how we're going to track their different stories? Because obviously you have limited resources as independent filmmakers. You had to make some critical decisions.
So as you said, Stephen, we wanted to kind of focus and cover three different angles of the story and
the issue, yeah.
Yeah, of the issue. And we had, unfortunately, so many people reach out to us because this isn't an uncommon problem. There are so many people that are suffering. But we firstly looked at Nicole Smith Holt and her husband, James, and their son, Alec Smith, who tragically died from insulin rationing, because that kind of just shows the catalyst of the problem and the extreme for someone that is trying to source their life-saving medication, but the end result is death. So we follow, obviously, the family journey and their experience of that tragedy, but then also turning it into a positive and following them trying to pass a bill within the Minnesota State Senate. And then secondly, we looked at a mother and daughter who are both type 1 diabetics and looking at having to choose rent or their life-saving medication. And then unfortunately, obviously not having a choice because they need the life-saving medication to survive. So losing their home and living in their car and becoming homeless. And then their adventure to looking at alternative options of becoming a medical refugee and going across the border. And then we have Cara, who is a newly diagnosed patient within the peak of the pandemic and kind of showing that, you know, how to survive in something that we were all struggling with at the time, a pandemic, but also with an autoimmune condition. And then looking at the physical, the emotional, and then down the line for her, the financial implications that was going to have. So it really shows the gamut of those three stories. And let's go to explain how we kind of found them.
Yeah, you know, Nicole and James Holt, they, you know, Alec sadly passed away, and it became a big issue in the state of Minnesota. It became the poster child of this issue. And right off the bat, we said, okay, well, this is a great starting point. Nicole is really making noise about it in Minnesota. So when we went to film with her, you know, she was well versed into a lot of what was happening. A lot of the other stories, we really, you know, I think the approach we wanted to do with this is, okay, this is a documentary about diabetes and medicine. Well, the challenge here is how do we make this engaging so it actually does get people up out of their seats to want to make change. And for us, that was to make it personable. And our approach was to really spend time with all of our film participants and show the struggles they were going through unfolding. That's why we spent so many years of filming, because it took Nicole and James, you know, three, four years to finally see some results or get some answers, you know, fighting just in Minnesota. And then spending time with Emma and Sandra and going with them to Canada and seeing that you know, that new, that life change that they encountered. And then during the, you know, pandemic and being there with Carl, who's just learning all about this, she knows nothing about it, and all those struggles. So, you know, all of that goes into documentary filmmaking, spending time with our characters to really get that access, but also get deep.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call. Click Grainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Into those stories.
Yeah, I really commend you both on the way you made it feel like you were living the experience with your main characters. You really felt the pain of each of these characters that were on this journey fighting for this life-saving medicine. I want to, for the audience listening who may not be informed, talk a little bit about the stranglehold that the three pharmaceutical companies have on the insulin and why this is such an important issue.
So, you know, unlike other countries, America, you know, doesn't, our government doesn't regulate the cost of medication. So it's really up to the manufacturers to kind of say, hey, this is the cost we want to, you know, sell it at. And there's a few things happening here. You know, there's there's only three big manufacturers that produce insulin in the United States, and they all kind of work within each other. One brings the price up, the other one follows suit, and they kind of dominate the market space for insulin, which makes it really hard for smaller manufacturers to come in and produce insulin to drive, to make competition to drive the cost down. And, you know, pharma also spends a lot of money in lobbying to try to kind of persuade policymakers not to pass bills for price caps. You know, I know there's been a lot of bills of copay caps, but again, copay caps, while they're good, they only help the those that are insured, not the uninsured. And also they drive insurance premiums up. So I think the root of the cause here is we need to get involved in, you know, stabilizing the price of the medication so it's affordable and accessible to everyone. And that's kind of been the struggle of, you know, we're running around in circles here. How do we fight this? So is it, you know, we're at a point now where, you know, the government, you know, might need to get involved and kind of put a ceiling and or, you know, work with smaller manufacturers and have the FDA start approving, you know, them to come into the market, because more competition would eventually drive the price down. So it's a really hard fight here in the United States.
One of the most powerful scenes for me was hearing the lobbyists talk in the Minnesota, you're in the Minnesota legislature, right? And, you know, you're talking about potential change, and there's the lobbyist with the spin. And, you know, you don't often get a window into what lobbyists do. We have kind of this evil vision, but to actually hear the spin, did you guys try and get an interview with the lobbyist? Did you try and like, what was that like to actually witness that interaction in person?
So I think, you know, before that, we were always had in our pocket, like, okay, well, we need to get to hear from the other side, and we're going to have to do the interview where they're going to kind of give us the spiel. But after that moment, we kind of said, oh my God, it just happened in front of all these people. And, you know, we didn't really influence it. We were just there with cameras. There was other camera people in that room. And that's it, right in front of you. It wasn't a set up interview, us asking them tough questions. No, they responded the way they do. And we felt, boom, that's it. We don't really have to try to persuade them to give us an answer, because they're not going to.
And I think that, you know, that's the beauty of true verite doc filmmaking, is to capture things and elements as they happen in real life without any influence. And that was our intention from the beginning of making this film, is to make a very heavy verite driven film that captures as many real life moments as possible, and to really go with everyone on those journeys. So as you said earlier, Stephen, you're immersed with that whole storyline yourself, and you feel like you're there. You feel like you're in that room. I'm watching the legislator speak and the lobbyists speak, and to have that kind of reaction. So that was really important to us, to kind of show it from that perspective.
I'm always fascinated by, in a film like this, when you're shooting over the course of multiple years and you don't really know what's going to happen, specifically with Alex parents trying to get legislation passed in Minnesota. Did you, in your mind, was the outline to the film constantly changing? Did you at least have, okay, well, we're going to finish this by 2022, 2020. Like, did you at least in your mind have an idea how it was going to end, or how you wanted it to end, or a plan B, a plan C? Like, how are you guys, you know, in the back of your mind thinking, okay, we're going to stop filming by X date? What was the thinking?
That's a great question. Two things kind of occurred at the same time while making this. Well, one, we knew it was going to be a very hard fight for Nicole and James, because, you know, you're trying to fight pharma, and they have a lot of money, and they have a lot of lobbyists walking up and down the state houses of every state trying to persuade, like I said before, policymakers from passing anything. So we knew it was going to be a struggle. It was a complete David and Goliath. And I think we stuck through it because even if the outcome turned a different way, we still had a very strong story to tell.
And so, I think on top of that, why, I mean, with all documentaries, if you had the luxury of endless funds or time, you could continually film forever and have so many great outcomes and stories that come from that. But we knew we wanted to finish it the beginning of 2023 to release in 2023 to then hopefully have an impact on the 2024 election, because it is a bipartisan issue and it is an issue that both sides do believe in having, you know, healthcare, and, you know, healthcare is a human right. So we wanted to put this focus in front of the politicians and legislators and ahead of 2024 so it can be one of the key points of discussion for the election.
I love that, that you guys had in mind a goal with policy in mind and an election. That makes a lot of sense. Keeping that in mind, as different pieces of legislation, you know, the $35 cap with Medicare popped up, were you having to kind of change in your mind as different states started to bring insulin costs into play? Were you changing interviews that you were doing, going back and getting pickup bites? How were you kind of adjusting over the course of multiple years as the climate even changed with the talk about insulin?
Yeah, well, it's one of those things, again, with documentary, you're constantly changing and you know, things happen, you know, changes are made. So yeah, we did have to kind of do some pickups and address those. And like we said, while these are good changes, they're not solutions. It still hasn't been a solution presented. And for example, the Inflation Reduction Act with the $35, you know, copay cap, while that was amazing, that's for people 65 and older. I mean, the majority of the people that are struggling to afford their insulin are those that are, you know, kind of young, coming out of college and having decent salaries, but a little too much to be qualified for a subsidy to get access to affordable healthcare, but maybe not enough to actually pay for it. So again, that wasn't a solution. And then, you know, kind of literally a week before this film premiered at South by Southwest, all the pharmaceutical companies decided to voluntarily lower their cost of insulin to $35. And, you know, again, advocacy is there. It does. However, we need to keep in mind that this was a voluntary move. This wasn't a pressure from government to say, this is what it has to be. No, this was for them to do it. They could raise that price tomorrow for all we know. And, you know, again, tactics, band-aid tactics to get us to hush, but it's important we keep the conversation going.
And I think what's important to keep in mind too is that like a documentary is documenting a specific moment in time. And it is that cautionary tale of like, look, this is what happened during this like 4-year period. Yes, they lowered the prices, but what we want to remind people is that this, what happened in this 4-year time period could happen again if they raise the prices again. So
how do we prevent it?
Yeah. So we need to, again, documentary always is evolving, but to kind of put those timestamps, we actually ended up putting slates and cards that explained the situation of what had happened. And so we could ensure that we got the film out there instead of them trying to probably put a standstill on the film and not get it out there by us running around having to get pick up interviews and do all of that. We were like, no, this is a very important story that still needs to come to the fore. And this is what happened in this specific time.
And what's important too is what we did document is fact. So regardless of what happens, people still died, you know, because of this, no matter what. That hasn't changed. That will not change. It happened. And, you know, like Rachel said, it is a cautionary tale because we don't want this to happen again. And regardless of things change, you know, people need to come forth and take responsibility and be held accountable.
I think that's incredibly important because they may feel like they're the good guys and the press may forget about this issue, but as you said, it still happened and it could happen again, whether it's insulin and diabetes or some other issue. I have a medical condition and I'm very fortunate that there are generic medications that lower the cost, but for a lot of folks who have certain conditions, they, you know, they're in the situation that the folks are in your film. And so we all know, you know, There's thankfully people like Mark Cuban who are doing things like cost plus drugs to lower the cost of medications. But we're all still in this situation that we shouldn't be in, where medications are way too expensive. I want to ask about Alex's parents, and talk to me a little bit about the tenacity and just the resilience that they've showed over the course of filming.
They became heroes. They served. They became a voice for millions of Americans that were struggling. And watching them transform over the year. And that's one of the greatest things about filming a documentary for so many years. You see people change. And that relates to anyone watching it. You know, when you're sitting there in a theater watching someone go from A to B and seeing that transformation, you relate as a human being, because as humans, we go through change and we do transform over time. And to see them rise up from not being anywhere in that realm of having a voice to having a voice and becoming hope for millions of Americans was truly amazing. It was an amazing experience to witness that and actually document that.
And I think too, what was so special was that because of Scott's, personal connection with it, Nicole and Scott even kind of formed a very close bond and a trusting bond, because, you know, I don't want to speak for you, Scott, but Scott saw what happened to Alec as something that could easily happen to him. And it was a true wake up call. And also too, for Nicole, like, I think she saw in Scott a lot of Alec in the terms of like, this is someone around the age of where you could fall off your parents' health insurance. And, you know, it's also too, I think the inspiration from what Scott did as a filmmaker and to capture this journey for them was really special moment for you to kind of share with Nicole and build that trust and James over such a short, it is short in the sense of, you know, it's their lifetime, but, you know, 4 years to for them to show the intimacy of their lives and what they did, that took a lot of trust in us as filmmakers. And then also too, I think that special relationship that Scott had with Nicole.
Because the topic is so close to you, Scott, what was the toughest part of the filming for you when maybe you thought, I don't know if I can do this?
Yeah, I mean, that was... It was a constant reminder being there. And look, it could happen to anyone. It's not necessarily about, you know, how much money you have or have you don't. Without my insulin, I'm dead in 3 days. I mean, you know, it's crazy. It's you know, and it was a constant reminder. It was really hard, you know, and I found myself tearing up a lot behind the camera. And also even in some of the situations, for example, with Cara, when she was trying to figure out her pump and all that, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh man, I want to put the camera down and help her, but I can't, because then I'm not, you know, showing the world the struggle, the challenge we go through. And of course, I mean, if it was a life or death situation, you know, that's different. But the challenge she was going through, A, she needed to be challenged so she could learn it, so it could become secondhand nature, because that's what you're living with. But B, the world needs to see that this is not just an easy condition to live with. It's an invisible condition, and without your medication, insulin's a true life-saving medication. Without it, you're dead. No ifs, ands, or buts. You are dead.
You mentioned picking up the camera, behind the camera. How much of the actual filming did the two of you do? Because it felt like this was the type of film where it was, hey, this is what's happening, get here now, where there wasn't plenty of time. Oh, let's go get this beautiful, well-lit interview room. And it wasn't the Beckham doc, or, you know, it wasn't Harry and Meghan.
We were there. I mean, we had to be there.
Yeah, I think too, like for Scott and I, our style of filmmaking is what we call true doc. Like it is on the ground. Was just primarily Scott and I in the field for the majority of the filming. We chose that specifically to make it a very intimate and safe and trusting environment for our subjects, and so that they felt comfortable with us, so that they would be as real as possible with us, and really lay their hearts on their sleeve and show us exactly what was going on. So that's, you know, something that we as filmmakers has always been our intention, is to really go back to the traditional model of true documentary filmmaking without any influence. So it was all Scott, I have to say that the filming, he did an incredible job by capturing all of these incredible intimate moments. And for me to be there to like assist and help out and interview. But that's a style that we, you know, we continue to hope to do, because I think, unfortunately, it's becoming a dying art with people having such tight schedules and not enough manpower or hours allowed in the field and to spend time with subjects. So, you know, I think it really shows in our footage. And as you said, Stephen, like people really resonate with it because they feel like they're in the room.
And I hate to say it, you weren't there just to assist and help. You, I mean, we did this together. This was, you know, a lot of creative decisions we did together. And while being in the field was a huge production just with the two of us, the post-production was heavily involved, going through all that footage, years of footage, and working with our post team and really trying to figure out how these stories weave, but also the challenges of like, how do we explain this complex health system and also like explain to people that don't know what type 1 diabetes is, like that informative thread. You know, you've done tons of research, and like, it's just, you know, we really needed each other.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
To make this film.
I want to ask you about MTV Documentary Films buying this movie, and it's now available for folks to watch on Paramount Plus, which is terrific. When I heard that, I was excited, but I was also kind of surprised. Like when you think of MTV, you think of a younger audience, and you know, certainly Alec at 26 passing away from this is young. But I was still kind of like, okay, well, this is great that MTV Documentary Films is buying this. How did that, can you you have to tell me everything, but can you kind of let us into the inside negotiations in terms of how they came into play here to buy this, which is, I think, is terrific.
MTV Docs, I mean, they really are now trying to hit on those films that are very focused stories that, you know, poke a bigger picture. You know, this case, type 1 diabetes and insulin, bigger pictures, healthcare, that really garner a larger audience. And if you look at the slate of films they've been acquiring, you know, it's not just, you know, for a young audience. I mean, these are very important films. These are films that are voicing millions of Americans to you know, everyone could relate to. So we're really happy with the direction that MTV Films has taken and become, allowing us filmmakers to be powerful with offering a voice and shedding light on the evils out there. So,
and I think too, very issue driven in a verite sense, like Eternal Memory this year, which is another brilliant film on their slate. And then Last Flight Home last year, I think it really goes back to showing true doc filmmaking that is issue driven. And, you know, we're really proud to be a part of that slate.
Not necessarily all about celebrities.
Yeah.
Just have to put that out there. You know, real people in this world.
Okay. So you, it's like you were reading my mind. My next question, I talk a lot about this, the state of kind of media and documentary filmmaking, or really even filmmaking today. We have a lot of music docs or celebrity focused docs. I mentioned Harry, Meghan, and Beckham. You know, Arnold just had his doc. Reggie Jackson got a doc. How do you feel about the state of documentary filmmaking right now?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because, you know, doc spans so many different things. You know, you're telling real stories, it's immediately doc. But I think there has been a shift in, you know, a lot of interest in those celebrity sports and all of that. And there's a lot more money involved in those too. You know, that's where it kind of makes it hard for the smaller docs that are also telling important messages, but might not have, you know, kind of the face of a celebrity, you know, kind of on the bandwagon there or highlighting or focusing on a celebrity. It just makes it difficult to compete in terms of getting a larger audience and getting into big time festivals. So, there is a lot. And also, you know, kind of what a lot of the networks want. And following the algorithms of what people are watching. It tends to lean more celebrity and true crime and cults. We need to shift. We need to shift because I think there is an audience out there that really need docs like this. And it goes back to why we had documentary in the first place. I mean, documentaries were to deliver messages, to make change, to provoke change. These are real stories. They're good stories. They resonate with so many people. And now we're seeing a lot more docs of just celebratoring the celebrities and highlighting the sports. And while that's all great, you know, there really needs to be some divide and some fairness there.
What advice do you have for anybody, any young documentary filmmaker or anyone who's like, I've got a great idea, I've got a great subject that I want to make a documentary about?
The most important thing to reiterate is really believe in yourself, and you have to believe in yourself and the story and the idea. But you also, especially within the market we're in, you have to kind of look at what is the purpose for you making it. Is it to make money? Is it for your career? Is it for the joy of filmmaking and because you want to be an artist and get a message out there? Like, there are so many different, paths that you can take in terms of filmmaking. And I wouldn't say that people should necessarily be, turned away, because it is a really, really difficult market right now. And it is a difficult time for filmmakers. But, you know, there has been ebbs and flows without this industry since the beginning of time. I just really encourage anyone who wants to get into documentary filmmaking to, it's definitely a passion. You have to really, really believe in it and be willing to kind of do the grunt work and kind of follow the trajectory of how difficult it is. But, you know, it's a profession that I couldn't trade, to do anything else, because it's just so heartwarming when you are able to change the lives of real people and have their unsung hero stories to be told. It's just something that is a dying art, but it's something that is just, I think, so important, and I wouldn't change it for anything else.
And I just would also say, embrace the process of making it. Find joy in that. It's not always about the goal of trying to be in Sundance or win an Oscar. You know, we're in a different world today. There are so many platforms. There are so many opportunities to get your film out there. Think outside the box. Don't limit your audience. You know, even though you have a niche story, figure out a way how it can resonate with millions of other people than just, people within your community. You know, what I find more and more is that in the audience, we've had so many people come to watch our films and knew nothing about this, but were struck and wanted to do more. It takes courage and commitment, but you'll find it through the process of making your project.
Rachel, Scott, thank you so much for joining me on No Script, No Problem.
Thank you so much. It was such a joy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Scott Ruderman and Rachel Dyer. Check out their documentary Pay or Die on Paramount Plus. Before I go, I want to talk a little sports. First round of the NBA playoffs are heating up. Will the Clippers choke? Yes, they always do. Will the Lakers ever beat the Nuggets? I'm sorry. No, they won't. They've lost 10 in a row. Will the Bucks be the biggest disappointment of the season and get upset by the Pacers? Yes. Yes, they will. But those aren't the questions I'm asking. I want to know, where are we going to be watching the NBA in the future? Well, the NBA's exclusive negotiation window with its existing domestic media rights partners, that's Disney's ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery's TNT, has concluded without a definitive agreement. Both ESPN and TNT currently hold national television deals worth a combined $24 billion, which expire at the end of the 2024-25 season. The NBA is now able to solicit offers from other potential suitors, including NBC, Amazon, Apple, YouTube, and Netflix. These companies have held at least preliminary conversations. The league aims to tap into the heightened demand for premium live sports content by targeting at least one streaming partner in its next cycle. Some people suggest the NBA could potentially double or even triple its annual domestic broadcast revenues to $75 billion. That is insane considering their ratings aren't even that spectacular. This, of course, would result in higher subscription fees and higher cable fees. Now, remember, Amazon already has Thursday Night Football and they get an NFL playoff game this year. Apple has Major League Soccer and Major League Baseball. YouTube has the NFL ticket. And Netflix has WWE as well as docuseries that follow F1, professional tennis, professional golf, and teams or players in pro football, basketball, and baseball. So while it would be a shame to see the TNT crew of Charles Barkley, Shaq, Kenny Smith, and Ernie Johnson, the best studio show in sports, lose their NBA games, I do see a situation where the price is just too high for TNT, Warner Brothers Discovery, and our guy, David Zaslav, to afford if Amazon, Apple, Netflix, YouTube decide to jump in and just start throwing money at this. Switching over to the women's game, superstar Caitlin Clark, the most prolific scorer in NCAA Division I history and the number one pick in the WNBA draft, will continue her association with Nike by signing a $28 million contract that spans 8 years and includes a signature shoe. I do hope it looks like a more of a lifestyle sneaker, the way kind of the Jordan has evolved. I think there is an opportunity if she has not just a women's shoe, but also a men's sneaker, to really be a big, big seller. Speaking of Caitlin Clark, local fans of her new WNBA team, the Indiana Fever, will get to watch her games thanks to a new broadcasting partnership with Tegna, a media group which has struck a groundbreaking deal to air 17 of the Fever's games on Tegna's Indianapolis stations. The move aims to capitalize on the growing popularity of women's basketball. Okay, that's going to do it for another episode of No Script, No Problem. For everyone listening, please remember to subscribe, download, and rate the show with 5 stars. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Stitcher, Amazon Music, and Audible. You can also find it on Bleav.com and at Bleav Podcast. Follow me on X, Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook, Threads, you name it. I'm out there. Email any questions you have to noscriptnoproblempodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Bleav@Bleav.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, I'm Steve Berkowitz for No Script, No Problem.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.